On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, all kinds of NL East chatter. We begin with the Philadelphia Phillies, who had quite the week against the Washington Nationals, a whole bunch of homers in the ninth inning. And then while we were talking about the Phillies, the Mets fired Carlos Mendoza. So we react to that, say how we got here with the New York Mets. Oh my goodness, 13 games under 500. We react to the latest in the CBA negotiations. Are they even negotiations at this point? MLB has a new website that they want you to look at. We'll talk about that. And of course, it is Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, the ugly. And of course, that means we're talking all things White Sox Pope. Let's do it. It's Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks the Washington Nationals might need another reliever or two. I'm Jake Mintz. That is Jordan Schusterman, and this is not a sustainable business model.
One, or two, or three, or four, or five, or six. It's like
not
the,
one,
the Miami.
Not two.
Yeah.
Not three. Not four.
I don't think the Nats are holding any sort of like, you know, hype parade of getting excited. Like, these are all the things that we still need to win a championship. One lefty reliever, two lefty relievers. We are going to talk about what happened in Washington, D.C. this week. Plenty more to get to on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. But as you mentioned, our opener is a lack of a closer.
The 2026 Washington Nationals are wonderful entertainment. Maybe not always for Washington Nationals fans, but for the greater baseball public. They provide a sense of hope, an idea that no game is ever over, that no lead is ever safe. If your favorite club is battling against these Nats, you cannot turn off your TV. If I was the commissioner's office and I was making my proposals to the Players Association, I would say every game should have the Nats. That is what would get people to watch. This week in the nation's capital, next to Freedom 250 soirees down the block on the mall, and the Nats had a party of their own as the Philadelphia Phillies came into town for what was a crucial series, the most important series the Nats have played in quite some time. After winning the first game, the Nats proceeded to cough up the final three in excruciating fashion, with the Phillies coming back with late onslaughts of runs in the late innings to steal all three of these games. I was at the first three games of this set. I was not there last night. And the Phillies, all of a sudden, are four back in the National League East.
Yeah, and I mean, we can, these games alone, as you witnessed, even the first one, I mean, anytime you have that kind of ridiculous rally, not just down to your last strike, but what was it, eight runs on Tuesday, I believe, with two outs in the ninth inning?
Eight runs with two outs down to your last strike.
What did that feel like in the stadium? Was there a point when you looked around in the press box and felt like, because you've been in a lot of Nats games this year, you've watched the Nats blow all kinds of leads. It's not like this is like the first week that the bullpen has had some struggles. But that right. was a special genre. And then to do it 3 days in a row with kind of a different sequence of pitchers, different sequence of pain. To me, what is so stands out about this is the fact that they did win that first game and kind of how the Nationals responded. This was a four-game series. And the opportunity here to really make a statement. We've been talking a lot about the Nats in recent weeks, building up to the opportunity for the Nationals at home, where they haven't had a lot of wins, hadn't had a lot of moments against good teams, to say, hey, like, we're here. Maybe not we're winning the World Series this year, but we have taken this step forward, and now we are not a team to mess with. Now we are not an automatic win on the schedule the way that they kind of have been for the last half decade.
And they weren't.
And you,
none of these games were automatic.
That's true. That's true. That's true. That's true. But I will
just
say
that the way in which they occurred was just so excruciating.
Well, and again, like, you circled this series, as you just mentioned, as that opportunity. And after they won on Monday, it was like, okay, maybe they're going to seize this chance. And then they didn't do that.
What is interesting is that the Nats were pretty open both before and during this series about this series being more meaningful. Typically, over the 162-game cliche fest, players and managers are often attempting to downplay the importance of any particular game or series. You see this all the time with like Red Sox Yankees, right? Nowadays. Oh, it's just another series. Oh, it's, you know. Yeah, you get it. That's not what was happening here. I mean, we had Clayton Beter after game one of this series, the Nats, probably best reliever. Quote, I don't think there's a team we want to beat more than the Phillies. They're close. They always draw fans here. Just want to beat them. We had Nats skipper Blake Butera admitting that he was a bit more aggressive with some of his bullpen usage in the second game because this was a series they really wanted to win. Hope, a dangerous beast once again. I don't know if we necessarily need to relitigate any of the individual moments from this cluster F fest.
Yeah.
But the upshot is that the Nats, despite having a very interesting and dynamic and productive offense and playing far above anybody's expectations for them, we have always said, Jordan, that the best way to be a bad team is to have a bad bullpen. It is the ultimate trump card because you can blow any game, right?
Yeah. It also like compounds, and we sort of saw that in the series because you just end up, once things start to go wrong, especially like even 2 days in a row, and you've used your quote unquote best guys to try and get these high leverage outs, and when all of those backfire, you're just stuck button mashing, essentially, in the manager's chair. And Blake Butera only has so much to work with. But
let me get in on
that.
Can I build off that point? Because what's been interesting about the way that the Nats have tried to pitch this year is they have adopted what has been for a long time the kind of the core principle of the Mariners pitching ideology, which is throw the ball in the strike zone. If you don't walk guys, getting ahead, throwing strike one, and being aggressive, yeah, it'll put more balls in play, but you're going to usually get a lot of outs. The problem is that the Nats relievers don't have the raw stuff to do that. And in my opinion, that is a dynamic that both predates the current baseball operations group. Many of the players on the roster in this organization were working in an environment that quite literally did not care how hard they threw ball four. And yet I do think that the new president of baseball operations, Paul Taboni, does deserve at least a little bit of flack for failing to identify any competent impact bargain bin relievers, which in a lot of ways is the mark of a good team. Good organization can like just create a Yennier Cano, you know, can just find guys that we've never heard of and turn them into something, and the Nats haven't done that yet. I do kind of want to steer the conversation back to the Phillies, if that's okay.
Yeah, well, I will just wrap up the Nats part of it by saying that the fact that their offense is good, because there are many terrible teams over the years that have terrible bullpens, and it doesn't feel like an outlier on the roster. You're just like, well, yeah, of course the bullpen is bad. The whole team's bad. The fans don't feel the pain as much of the bullpen being bad because they're not even holding leads because they don't have leads because they're not scoring runs. The whole team sucks. I do think it is relevant that the Nats have this other part of their team that's going so well, giving their fans reasons to be excited and feel like even if they are smart enough to know that they're not going to win the World Series this year, there is still something that's really deflating and discouraging, right? I mean, that is to still have this opportunity because the young hitters and even some of the young starting pitchers want to feel like they're moving in the right direction. And I think it's a little bit harder for them to just shrug it off and be like, well, of course, we're not supposed to be good this year. Our bullpen sucks. Like, so what?
Well,
that's
mentality,
I think.
The absence of that mentality, the fact that this Nats team, having been around them, is refusing to think of themselves that way, that has been a key factor behind their success. That, like, they are not just here to get better. They are here to win, and they are here to win now, even though they may not. Well, you can hold that in one hand, but when you go out there three nights in a row and your bullpen is not up to big league quality, it is tougher to then kind of reaffirm that idea within your clubhouse over time, where it's like, are we here to win or do I need to watch this again? You know, it is this roster right now is like the inverse of the meme of like the Bugatti in the garage of the, you know, ramshackle house, mm-hmm, where it's like there, it's like a nice house with like zero, like the awful landscaping or something. Mm-hmm. Like the offense is legitimately good, and I think their process is good and they're moving in the right direction. But boy, oh boy, the bullpen is not tenable.
Yeah, and that would be the last thing I would just say about Toboney. I don't want to – he just got this job. He's really – like, it's not like I was thinking he was going to build a super bullpen. But I do agree that that is something they're going to have to prove is – and that's also on the coaching staff and just general pitching game planning strategy, that who whatever personnel you have there, it needs to be better than this for everybody's sake. And I'm sure that that is something they're slowly figuring out. It is not something you're going to be able to figure out, just flip a switch and fix. But I hope that they do to some degree so that this season doesn't veer off in a way that is no longer a positive. Because that's as much as they've accomplished this year, I hope that there's still a lot of time for it to end up being a very, very bad season. And I hope that that's not the case because of this.
If you don't fix the problem, there's a chance it spirals on you and snowballs and negatively affects the way that the good things are going. Let's move to the Phillies, who, you know, in April, the end of April, fired their manager, Rob Thompson. I was there that day, and the energy around the park was one of sadness and not really like fury. It was disappointment and not anger. And it was almost like, now that you look back on it, and this is maybe 2020 hindsight, there was a feeling that was almost like, well, we're going to figure this out. Like, the Phillies are going to be okay this year. And it's a bummer that Rob Thompson won't be there for that, right? Mm-hmm. That he had to fall on the sword, even though it was not really his fault. And part of the reason I firmly believe it wasn't his fault is that I don't think that Don Mattingly is doing anything fundamentally different than what Rob Thompson was doing. And so the Phillies getting back to where they've been the last, you know, half decade, I just think is a product of not changing a whole lot and trusting that you do have a lot of things going well. You do have a lot of talented players. But at the end of the day, what I found most encouraging seeing the Phillies is that the party here is not over. You know, that this core in the end of April was starting to at least having to consider staring the end of this operation in the face, seeing it on the horizon, witnessing one's own eventual, like, the mortality of this group, right? That there is an end date and it will come fast. And for the Phillies, that's unique because of how old this core is with Harper and Schwarber and Turner and whatever, right? And what they have done over the last 2 months, now four games back in the division, is to say, I am not leaving. We are not done here yet. For at least one more summer, people can come to Citizens Bank Park, drink 8 beers, and believe that there's something at the end of the season.
Yeah, and Bryce Harper is a huge part of that, and we could talk about him here as our last little Phillies zoom in. But it's also why you do what you need to do to get Kyle Schwarber back, because none of this is possible if you don't make sure you bring him back. Now, could you say the same thing about JT Realmuto? Probably yes, to some degree. Although, you know, that's the Phillies catching situation right now is certainly not in an awesome place. But hey, we love Garrett Stubbs and want him to do his best. Rafael Marchand doing his best to hit more than, you know,
Garrett, who played third in the ninth inning.
Oh, okay, sure.
The other night, as a pinch runner. Yeah, the Phillies are still, you know, they're not a perfect team. Derek Hill, who was the hero this week, is getting a lot more playing time than I think anybody expected Derek Hill would have.
Yeah.
Rincones has been fine to uninspiring. Mm-hmm. They're a bat short, in my opinion. They might be an arm short in the pen. Mm-hmm. Like, right. They are Painter. Not a perfect team. But the Painter situation is not great. They need a fifth starter. But all that considered, this is a really good baseball team. And that is because they are getting to run Zach Wheeler, Christopher Sanchez, and Jesus Luzardo out there 3 out of 5 days.
That certainly helps. But, they were 10.5 back on May 22nd. And they are now four back. The Braves are also scuffling. Let's talk about Bryce Harper quickly, because this is just so weird.
Hilarious.
How would you... Now, you were not at the game last night, so you were not in the scrum post game for this back and forth. No. But describe to me what happened.
So Bryce Harper pitched.
Yeah. Right.
I spent a lot of time this week like talking to Bryce and thinking about Bryce and talking to people about Bryce. And so this is very much on my brain, and I do have thoughts.
So what happened here?
So the Nats have had a very sticky tarps off crew. It is consistent. They're there all the time. It's like particularly vulgar. There's a lot of like F the player that's hitting.
Mm.
It's not even like just overrated chance. Like there was F Trey Turner. There was obviously F Bryce Harper. There was the booing you get whenever Bryce Harper comes to DC. Booing that I personally think is like both fair and unfair. Fans can boo, go nuts. Bryce Harper is not on the Nat. Like the reason that Bryce Harper didn't live his whole life as a National is not because of Bryce Harper. Like it is because the ownership group didn't really want to pay Bryce Harper. Like if the money had been there, Bryce Harper probably would still be there. You know what I mean? And so to boo him for that is just kind of doesn't make sense to me. It's not like he demanded a trade. Gave his all for that organization for 7 years, whatever. What happened last night, though, certainly threw some fuel on the fire. Bryce Harper hits a two-run backside bomb in the top of the ninth, game winner. And as he rounds first, he sticks a finger up to the tarps off crew that had been chanting at him all game, does it again as he rounds home. Now, the finger that he stuck at them was not his middle finger. It was his ring finger. After the game, Bryce was like, yeah, you know, I heard it. I gave my all for this organization. I feel bad that they're booing Trey, who won a World Series here. And it was just my ring finger. It wasn't my middle finger. To me, this is a swing and a miss from Bryce. This is a swing and a miss from Bryce. Now, I don't think him pointing the ring finger in his mind had anything to do with like a championship, right? Like, I don't think he was saying like, I got not a ring and you don't, which is obviously not true, right? However, not thinking about that. Correct. Yeah. Correct. Correct. Go ahead.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, I think people misinterpreted that because normally that is why you would put up your ring finger. I think that this is so. First of all, let's establish some facts. Based on the video, we think that is accurate. He did actually put up his ring finger. Can we just establish that first? Because yes. With the batting gloves, it's a little bit hard to tell. But I'm asking you. Do we think that that's accurate? That he is actually putting up his ring finger.
I do believe.
I think so. Okay. So now let's go with that. So. Is the interpretation that Bryce Harper basically saying, yes, I was flipping them off, but I was doing it with my ring finger so you can't find me? Like I don't want to actually tell them F you, so I'm going to do this like I'm in third grade and I don't want to be vulgar, so I'm going to put up my ring finger even though it's clearly, if you're looking at it and you're drunk in the tarps op section, it looks like you're being flipped off. I don't understand, because
it's almost
player,
like if you went up
you
to
would
someone
get fined,
like
if you flipped off the fans, right? And so could he still get fined for this? I'm not sure.
It's clever. It's like if you have a swear jar in your house growing up and you tell your mom, you're like, frick you, you freaking piece of stuff. Like technically you did not violate the terminology of or like the rules of the game, but you did
the spirit.
You did spiritually. Yeah. This was weird from Bryce. I think that what would not have been weird is if he had just waved at them. Right? To me,
salute.
If he hits a home run and wins the game and he's like, you keep chanting, everyone, like, appreciate you. Like, I see you. Like, but trying to thread the needle and flipping the bird is just very odd and kind of dad energy, and a reminder that Bryce Harper is now 33 and maybe not sticking the landing all the time. Usually when Bryce Harper does something cool, the way that he acts about the cool thing he did makes the thing cooler, right? Like whether that was winning the Derby and throwing the bat in the air, or when he hit the home run against the Padres, bedlam at the bank, and he just didn't react and just did the thing where he showed the Phillies. Like, he usually elevates moments with his disposition. This was the opposite of that, and I am bummed out by it because I want Bryce Harper to never grow old, and it makes me feel as if I'm not cool anymore. You know what I mean?
It's actually an interesting reflection. Just incoherent and strange, I would say, which frankly, as unfortunately we've acknowledged, is sometimes the case with Bryce Harper. So
I will say, though,
in that sense, I
Bryce
can't
Harper
be shocked.
This week was as good of a mood as I have ever seen Bryce Harper.
Great.
Like, he was, yes, he's hitting well, and the Phillies are playing great, but like,
yeah,
he was upbeat as I've seen him. So Bryce Harper, fascinating character. Jordan, before we take a break, we'll talk about this. We have news here.
Hey, this is good
timing.
I
have some crow to eat.
You sure do. We're going to get the, in fact, we'll save it. Hey, Carlos Mendoza, not managing the Mets anymore. That happened probably right around the time we were talking about Clayton Beter, is when producer Andrew Hartz hopped in the Slack and said, hey guys, Carlos Mendoza got fired. So we're going to take a break. The Braves, hey, congratulations to the Braves. You're off the hook for us talking about you on today's episode, because even though you just got swept for the first time all season and your division lead has dwindled, we get to talk about the Mets instead. So maybe if the Braves keep losing, we'll talk about them, but we'll move them to the side. We will take a break and we'll come back and we will talk about Carlos Mendoza getting fired. Before we go, let me remind everybody that the Yahoo MLB YouTube channel is launching on July 10th. That will include all things Baseball Barbercast, and we are so excited for that to be the case. We're going to take a break when we return. We're going to talk about Mets, believe it or not. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Big news. The New York Mets have fired, parted ways, let go, laid off their skipper, Carlos Mendoza. I have been adamant, or at least I was adamant for much of this season as the Mets tumbled down into an abyss, a whirlpool of woe, that none of this was Carlos Mendoza's fault, that the roster construction and the player performance did not fall on this man's shoulders, considering, one, how bad the roster had been playing, and two, he is definitely good at being a manager. And I figured that David Stearns, the Mets president of baseball operations, understood that this was not Carlos Mendoza's fault, right? That this was not his burden to bear. However, I think it reached a certain point this week where the Mets had to do something. And that something is getting rid of a guy who, in my opinion, like, he'll get another job like almost immediately, like next year. This is a really unfortunate way for his time in Queensland.
Yeah. So let's just get to that point you made, which, again, I was in agreement with, even though I did think that this was ultimately an outcome that we could arrive at. David Stearns said as much, right, on multiple occasions, even when the Mets were losing and losing and losing. And I do believe that David Stearns didn't necessarily think that. I think he was in line with what you were saying. But my point all along was, that's fine. At some point, the guy who's above David Stearns, who's spending a lot of money on this baseball team, is going to say something has to change. We have to acknowledge to the fans that there is something wrong. And as we always talk about with managerial firings, this is what you do, or at least this is the number one lever that you pull if you're not going to fire a pitching coach or shake some other stuff up. And so there's different levels of doing this, but this is when you reach a low, which we should say, getting mopped at home by the Cubs this week, including even by 2026 Mets standards, some particularly egregious and embarrassing performances. This is exactly the kind of time that you would see. But as we see, like, this is very rare in Mets history and even in general baseball to see managers get fired, you know, before the All-Star break, just as we talked about with Cora.
The tipping point this week, in my opinion, was how the Mets lost to the Cubs and how disjointed and unengaged and unenthused and utterly punchless they appeared in this very crucial series at home. They made 6 errors in a game. All infielders. First time they'd made 6 errors since the frickin' Obama administration. And I think that level of lethargy made it easier to justify firing Mendoza here. Because I didn't think that even earlier in the year as the Mets like were losing games, they didn't look like a disengaged bunch, right? Mm-hmm. They just weren't hitting. Like, that was the story of the first big Mets, like, swoon.
I agree.
It was like, this team sucks because they can't hit. Over the last 10 games, it's like, oh, this team's just, like, kind of checked out and, like,
just doesn't have it.
That is what it appears from afar. Now, maybe that's not the case. I have not been around the Mets as much this year, but this is a sorry operation right now. An abysmal job of roster construction. There are certain aspects of this team that David Stearns, who crafted it, deserves criticism for, and some places where I think he deserves some leeway. Lindor and Soto missing so much time, or when Soto went out. You know what I mean? Like, those two pieces not being healthy the whole year, that is meaningful. The same is true with Clay Holmes. I think we maybe could have foreseen that all the injured free agents or the oft injured players they acquired over the winter, whether that's Luis Robert or Jorge Polanco, getting injured. Like, whoa, I can't believe it, right? Like, Nolan McClain struggling to evolve into a full-blown ace is something that I won't admit is happening because I love Nolan McClain. But I would imagine a reasonable person could have foreseen that outcome. And so what we have here is a failure. It is a failure on David Stearns' shoulders, but he can't fire himself. And so Carlos Mendoza ends up carrying that torch, which just bums me out.
Yeah. And I just think that, you hit on a lot of them, but I mean, the Nimmo for Semien, who at least was healthy until now. I mean, that's at the very least you could count on him playing. Now he's on the injured list too. He's got a 613 OPS. No one is necessarily shocked by that. We talked about Freddy Peralta being a pretty gigantic disappointment so far. That one is, I think, more of just a genuine surprise. I think that was more of a straightforward move that we thought was like, yep, makes sense. Freddy Peralta's good.
That's in the couldn't have planned for this category.
Sure.
Mets pitching dev is a thing that I think is good. Mm-hmm. Freddy Peralta is a talented pitcher. He seems like a guy who is going to enjoy pitching in this big market. That hasn't gone together, right? However, relying a lot on Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos to be offensive difference makers, that we could have seen, right? Like, there are two categories of things here. And I think that Stearns definitely, it's not a hot take, deserves a lot of blame.
That's the thing. And I do think just on the whole, it has been more bad planning than bad luck based on how it has unfolded. I do think that. There's always a little bit of both when we're talking about disappointing teams. But I do think at this point on the whole, you have to say, I mean, Bo Bichette is another interesting part of this conversation. He's closer to the Freddy Peralta level.
He's closer to Freddy Peralta for me because he has not been, like, the Bo Bichette story has not been Bo Bichette can't handle playing third base. The Bo Bichette story has been, for the first time in a long time, a healthy version of Bo Bichette is simply not hitting.
Yes.
Like, what?
Yes. That's true. And that is weird. I definitely agree with that. That said, just, you know, bringing it back to Mendoza, it's just, this is what you have to do. There, you know, Andy Green's taking over as interim manager. It's weird.
Give a little Andy Green context. Give a little Green context. What?
I mean, I can't give a lot of Andy Green context as to what he is on the Mets right now. Is he on the major league staff? I thought he was in a front office.
No. So I just meant that Andy Green, who was the manager of the Padres like right before they got good.
16 to 19.
Okay. I believe, did he ever manage in the brown and yellow? I don't believe so. I think he was kind of the last gasp of the blue.
That was 2020.
Andy Green, I believe, was the farm director for the Mets before taking this job, but as the only person around with major league managerial experience, I had kind of gathered asking around, like, hey, if Mendy goes, who's it going to be? Kai Correa, who I believe is still the bench coach, has never been a full-time manager. That was probably not going to be his job if Mendy got fired, and that it was going to be Andy Green. So now Green steps into this role trying to right the ship. That'll be interesting. But yeah, I just, part of the reason I feel bad for Mendoza, and I think that like most Mets fans, most reasonable Mets fans look at the situation and understand that like he's a fall guy. He's not even a scapegoat, but like he is not at fault here. And I think that Mendoza is just like such a decent, good dude. And like that doesn't, you know, that doesn't help you win championships. I understand. But like you even saw it the other day, you know, this tragic earthquake that happened in Venezuela. He opens his press conference after the Mets, as the Mets are just in this tailspin, and says, hey, like, I just want to let everyone know, I want to draw some attention. My thoughts are with my people. My family is safe. I think friend of the program, Chelsea Janes, did a thing that I think more reporters should do, which is, how are you doing? Like, ask, like he's like, Mendy, like, how are you? Are you good? He's like, I'm okay. Like, I'm handling it. You know, and obviously our thoughts go out to all those people in Venezuela that just a shocking, horrifying loss of life and a tragedy for a country that has been such turmoil. And Mendoza, who has been like a really beautiful representative of Venezuelan baseball throughout his entire career, and including during his time with the Mets, he will manage again. I think he and Alex Cora should arm wrestle for the Phillies job next year. If the next Phillies full-time manager is neither of those guys, I would be pretty surprised. Like if it's a third thing.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I do agree that
Dabrowski before, and then like Mendoza is very close with Rob Thompson because they were with the Yankees together for a long time, and I think Thompson's going to stay around the organization. But the upshot here is that like what has occurred in Queens is not an indictment of Carlos Mendoza's ability to do the job. I think it is an indictment of the way that this roster was built. However, given what occurred over the last week, the way that this team looked, it made it much easier for him to get fired. And when I pounded my fist on the table and I said, I don't think they'll fire him, part of my belief in that was that the team would eventually turn it around, right? Mm-hmm. I thought that they were going to wait out the awful start, right the ship, and maybe not win 90 games, but get back to a level of competence where the team was playing well enough that they didn't need to fire Mendoza. This second dip to me is similar and different and is why we're having this conversation today.
100%. And I think that bringing the Phillies back into this, and by the way, guess who's coming to town this weekend? The Philadelphia Phillies riding in with some tremendous vibes into whatever the heck is going to feel like Queens in Queens this weekend. I mentioned that May 22nd mark when the Phillies were 10.5 games back of the Braves. Yeah, May 21st, the Mets, that's right when the Mets and Phillies are in the same place. And that is what is also interesting to me about this timing, because part of the, I mean, this is also true for the Red Sox, although we've shown that that isn't necessarily going to be the case. The leadership's argument of saying we need to do this now, we need to do this earlier than normally you see managers getting fired, is we still believe in this team. And it's interesting the contrast between part of why, to your point, they maybe didn't fire Mendoza is because they believed in this team. Whereas now firing him is almost like it's weird. Like, could this still be construed as we still believe in this team?
No, I get what you're saying.
We didn't want to let him stay until the trade deadline. It's a strange difference there.
So the context of last season is important, where David Stearns, as the Mets, remember, had this catastrophic collapse in the second half. We believe in this group. We believe in this group. We believe in this group. Season ends. The group fails to make the playoffs. We need to evaluate what went wrong, and we need to make decisions. That was not good enough. Great. This season, as they started playing terribly with a basically totally different group, we believe in this group. We believe in this group. David Stearns, for really the first time, slightly gave a different indication. The tone changed a little bit when he talked this week. I'm interested to see what he says today. I would imagine he's talking today. But you are right. That, like, struggling teams can adopt one of two, you know, types of messaging. They can either say, trust us, or this isn't good enough. We are evaluating how it can get better, right? And I think that the Mets, how, like, the needle is now moving towards, is moving away from trust us, because you can't anymore.
Right, right. So I just don't know, like, is this, how well would they have to play now? I mean, they're 13 games under. They're not playing any sort of way that gives you, it goes back to the same thing with the Phillies. We could always lean on those characters that we've seen be really good, and also just the true talent level of what they have on their roster. Whereas the Mets, it's just like, why do I think that they're suddenly going to start playing better? What is on this team that makes me think they're about to go on a run? There's nothing. And that's also why we talked about the Red Sox, right? And that's what's become clear now, is that is the analog. The Mets and the Red Sox are the teams this year, throughout all the chaos, they're just, it's not anywhere close to as good as what their front office seemed to have thought, and what a lot of us looking at the rosters going into the season seem to have thought that they actually were. Now, the Mets waited a lot longer to fire their manager, for better or for worse. And there's a lot of other context involved with Cora compared to Mendoza, for sure. And the relationships between the front offices and the coaching staff, because that's also how a lot of these things happen. But then it also just comes back to ownership too, right? And I think that would be my last Mets point here, and where, not to be like, haha, I was right, but this is why I just always thought this was going to happen. Even if they were floating at 5 or 6 games under 500, I just thought there was going to be a day where Steve Cohen wakes up and says, what are we doing? This is absurd. I have to change something. I'm not just going to sit here and watch this and watch the Mets fans, because again, right, Steve Cohen is a Mets fan. At some point, he's going to start feeling like a Mets fan and say, something's got to do something, and he's the one that can make a change. Now, what this means for David Stearns moving forward, whether David Stearns has lost the trust of Steve Cohen, that is also really interesting. And I think a more interesting conversation than, I mean, it is also interesting with Breslow because of the way that ownership talks about Breslow. But both of these organizations right now are in really interesting spots now, having moved on from managers that a lot of us believe to be good, because now it really is all about the front office. And we're not going to talk about Andy Green, no matter what happens the rest of the season. I guess, sure, the Mets win 20 in a row, we're talking about Andy Green. But I just think that, you know, David Stearns is, and I was saying this even at the start of the season when we were talking about Mendoza's job security, Stearns now is in such an interesting place. And we're gonna learn a lot, because they've, same thing with Boston, they've made a lot of big moves, big changes, like bold decisions, that is like the team in his image. And here we are, Mets in a very, very, very bad place.
It is not a particularly good image at this point in time. I am currently reading the book about Steve Cohen's financial career called Black Edge.
Finally.
Mm-hmm. And if I had read that before the season, I might have had a different opinion on his level of cunning and ruthlessness. Give that book a read, everyone. There's a lot in there.
Hey, I think we should take a break. We'll come back and talk CBA. The one thing I do want to mention, because I guess it was the other bit of Mets news, and it is related to the team that kicked their ass for 4 games this week, is that they traded David Peterson to the Cubs. Now, how important is David Peterson? He's longest tenured Met, right? So in kind of a funny act of symbolism, that last pre-Cohen era Met, right, as we are just talking about what is this new Mets era under Stearns and Cohen, now he's gone, right? They trade him to the Cubs, who are in somehow even more desperate need for pitching than they were a few weeks ago when I saw them in Pittsburgh and Jed Hoyer was like, oh my God, our pitching depth is being stretched to its limits. And I was like, oh, well, it can always get worse. There's always more arms to get injured. And now here they are without Edward Cabrera and Ben Brown, who I should mention, both of those injured, not even arm related. So they're losing pitchers to non-arm injuries. But now they pick up David Peterson, who's going to be a free agent this offseason. And he gets ground balls, and he gives up a lot of runs because he allows a lot of balls in play that are hit pretty hard. But right now, the Cubs need major league pitchers, and I do believe David Peterson is a major league pitcher who will benefit for the Cubs' defense. The Cubs are also just playing some really good ball right now. They continue their seesaw from being the hottest team in baseball to the coldest team in baseball. Right now, they're looking really good. They've climbed all the way back up to second in the NL Central. They are not quite as close to first place as the Phillies are, the way that, you know, they're trying to catch up to the Brewers, Phillies trying to catch up to the Braves. But give credit to the Cubs, because they were also in a pretty dark place, and they have now managed to get back on track and are playing some very good baseball. And David Peterson is going to have to throw some important innings for them over the next few months, sure, for better or for worse.
Wow. How about
Oh, and the Marlins are that, Marlins are in this division too. NL East.
Let's take
a week in the NL East. Oh my god.
Saucy stuff in the NL East. Let's take a break, Jordan. When we get back, we'll do CBA and GBE.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. There is something that we need to talk about.
But it's not something that we want to talk about. CBA. CBA. CBA.
Get hyped, folks. Our favorite topic is back. As MLB has and the MLBPA arrived at the table, bargaining table. Is this a table? Is this a physical table? Are they meeting at the same table every time? Where is this happening?
Let us know. BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com.
We could probably find out. We probably know the people to ask. We figure out what table, what the table
looks like. We do know the people to ask, but when we would ask them, they'd be like, are you really wasting my time asking me whether we're bargaining at the actual same table? Does the table say bargaining on it, the bargaining table? Anyway, I digress.
What I was about to say is, okay, we got another round of negotiations this week, but I don't think that's really what's happening, right? Where we're at right now, as we barrel towards December 1st, is not negotiation. It is both sides coming out and saying, here's what we want, here is what we believe. And I do think that this was a significant development this week, because MLB not only did they leak a couple of the parts of their proposal to sort of members of the media and put up a story at MLB.com being like, here's what we would like to do. We would like a salary cap, and here's a salary floor, and here's a way that baseball is going to be more fair, and we're going to grow the game together, and here's all the systems. So we've had a few versions of that. This is a new level of MLB telling us what they want, because not only are they telling us what they want, they are presenting it in a way that is telling us actually what we want, the fans. They have launched a website on as part of MLB.com, MLB.com/levelthe-playing-field. And wouldn't you know it, they are going exactly the direction that I expected. And I got to give it to them. Pretty smart. Pretty smart way to do this. Now, the details of this proposal, the details of this proposal in terms of the actual finances of, oh, here are all the things we're giving the players. Look, we're raising the minimum salary to historic levels. We're allowing them to maybe reach free agency after 5 years. We are giving them all these things. Well, obviously, all of that comes with a massive shrinking of their maximum earnings potential, including straight up limiting the size of free agent contracts. This is the most explicit version that we've seen, where they're very directly proposing, and this is the only thing that would make sense under a cap system that we see in other sports, which is basically what we have in the NBA. Which is the best players, the max players, make a certain percentage of your payroll. That is what you're able to do, which obviously is a maximum number. It is that is very clear. That means that there is a number that a player cannot make more than. Now, I've thought a lot about how in the world that would function in a sport like baseball, where your best player is not anywhere close to as important as the best player in basketball is, where, yes, it makes all kinds of sense to give the best player on your basketball team X percentage of your cap, because that best player on your basketball team can probably single-handedly win you 40 or 50 games in a way that, like, I don't even know how you would calculate what a max player is worth in baseball under this system, because there's a lot more baseball players on a baseball team.
Here's the thing, though, man. Like, it's so difficult for me to find, like, to get up for this now, because
for sure,
like, I have 24 hours a day to live, and right now there's ball on, right? Mm-hmm. There's things happening on the field that are interesting and meaningful and compelling. In the winter, there's no ball on. Well, there's no big league ball on. When that time comes, I will be more than happy to engage with you on the nitty gritty details here. But for now, it's just like, I feel like we're talking about things that are just so unrealistic. It's like,
well, and also
the proposal to limit free agent contracts to 5 years is just such a preposterous goalpost that it's almost not even worth really considering the merits of it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so I just don't even know how to evaluate or what to say about it. I think the most important upshot of what we've seen in the last week is that the league continues to kick the PA's butt in terms of messaging. If you are listening to this podcast, like, you are almost already too close to the screen and, like, too in and, like, too much of a hardcore fan for the league to be, like, trying to talk to you, if that makes sense. Like, they're trying to make this even wider. Like, obviously, I'm saying you, the listener, you're important. We love you. I'm not saying you're useless and pointless. I would never. What I'm saying is that, like, MLB's messaging here is clearly directed at, like, a wider demographic of people. Like, they're trying to go, like, more bird's eye view. And so far, I think that is succeeding.
Well, and that's the thing, and we'll say this every time we bring this up. I'm sure there are going to be parts of these conversations that we express our opinion and our view that does not necessarily align with even fans that are maybe more pro-labor or more pro-player than they are pro-owners. That said, it's this website that I referenced that they're now promoting, MLB.com/level playing field. It is exactly what I kind of hinted at when we first started talking about this at the beginning of the season. How is their messaging? What direction are they going to go? And I predicted, I said, what they're going to do is they're going to say, look, we made baseball better already. Trust us. We have improved. We've made this game better for you because you asked for it. The fans asked for it. You wanted this. And so that's what the premise of this video. In fact, this website includes a video of someone going out into MLB stadiums at some point and asking fans, hey, what's wrong? What's right with baseball? And you just have this supercut of 10 random fans around the country being like, I wish it was more fair, in wearing all these different jerseys. Oh, I really wish that you know, this sport is not. And I think what is going to be really difficult and strange throughout this whole thing is MLB's messaging being like, MLB is in a bad place. We have to fix this. And it's like, I don't know. Like, I feel like we're doing pretty well. I feel like there's a lot of things that are going well. But the messaging is, this is what you want. They say on the website, the game is about hope and competition. Too many fans and markets across the game have too little hope that their team has a fair chance to win. There are absolutely elements of truth to that. Indisputably, we hear from them on this. People that listen, 100%, right? Why that is not necessarily what they are getting at. And I think the premise of trying to cut down on spending at the top and punish the teams that are giving the fans what they want, which is showing that trying to win, raising the floor is good, right? Forcing the teams that are not spending. Sure, they are acknowledging, well, great, look, more teams would spend more money under this proposal than would be bringing them. The teams at the bottom would spend more money than the teams at the top would be spending less. It's like, okay, great. The point is, the messaging here is interesting. The fact that they are trying to convince the fans of what they want as opposed to the players, because right now it is not a matter of them trying to convince the players to accept this. It's about turning the fan sentiment and turning, I guess, the fans against the players. These are the early stages of that. Now, how productive is that? How effective is that going to be? That'll be a conversation for the winter.
Like, what impact does it actually have now? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day? Yeah. Like, I've talked to people on both sides about this, is like, mm-hmm. we've said this before, the way that we see ourselves in this dynamic is that like the people in the media are acting on behalf of the fans, where the league is trying to save money, make money. The union is trying to make money for its members, and the game itself can often get left outside, right? Can get mm-hmm. side, like what is good for the sport. However, I do think that like we need to try and to the best of our ability, like, yes, the league wants to pay the players less. Like that is a fact. And whether that is the motivating factor or not, I do think is relevant. What's mm-hmm. the upshot? What's the actual impact of a proposal? Does it create a better sport or not? Does it create a better sport for whom or not? That is what we need to evaluate, because like I said this a million times, I don't care if the players are making more money or less money. That really does not mean anything to me, right? What is the proposal? What is the impact? We can't evaluate the impact of any of these proposals yet because they're so preposterous. They're so ludicrous. They're just they're just so unrealistic. And so that's where I'm kind of left.
Yeah, and I wanted to reemphasize that point that you made, because I do think that that is the thing that I keep coming back to also, which is that by the time we get to December and we are actually comparing proposals and actually thinking about the details of these things, they're going to look so different than what they do right now, because, and maybe this is a good thing and why they're already coming out, as frustrating as it is to read some of these now, if they can inch closer to each other over the next few months, hopefully there's less work to do once we actually start having some hard conversations during the lockout. Now, that's probably an optimistic interpretation, but to your point, these specific details of these proposals, I don't believe are going to be relevant. Little elements of them are going to remain as things that are actually being negotiated. But right now, MLB is just coming out swinging and being like, baseball is broken, which is, again, a funny thing to see on MLB.com. But, you know, I do think that that is where we're at right now. And once we get to December, you know, we'll keep checking in because it is news. But I agree with you that trying to weigh the merits of it right now, it's just hard to really talk about. So, all right, from CBA to something a lot more fun, it's time for GBU, the good, the bad, the ugly.
One thing good, one thing bad, one thing Dan Ugla-esque. Jordan, start us off.
My good this week was my trip to the MLB Draft Combine, specifically my conversations with a few of the high school players. And I mention that because in our experience doing this over the years, and now granted, this is also us just getting, you know, old and crusty and whatever, so maybe that's just it's a generational gap. But would you say it's fair to say that oftentimes when we are interviewing players, this does not apply to all, but oftentimes those who come out of high school or drafted out of high school, it's not that they can't be more interesting and engaging and have, you know, wide vocabularies and interesting worldviews and
there
personalities.
There are Pete Crow Armstrongs.
But there are PCAs out there for sure. But there are also a lot where it's just like they've been in the baseball, like baseball, it's only been baseball the whole time. They didn't have a college experience where they maybe lived somewhere else. And so it's just, they kind of have less to work with in terms of what
they're as the
talking
about.
Thing.
Yeah. It's the, do they know how to cook a chicken? Do they know how to mow a lawn? Do they know how to go to the DMV? Do they know how to live a life? Now, again, being a college D1 high level athlete, like there's still a lot of things that get done for you. Yes. But when you have to navigate the real world, it gives you the skills. It makes you better equipped to be a good interactor. I do think, Jordan, that kids these days are older than they've ever been or older than they've ever felt. And is that what you're going to touch on, that you had interesting conversations with high schoolers and you were impressed by their general disposition?
Yes. Yes, but I think it's also, it's not even as much about like, oh, the life skills or how smart they are or their baseball IQ. It's just like, they're just fun to talk to. Like they, and the confidence and charisma and like social engagement and comfort to talk to media and from what I understand, to also talk to teams. Again, this is a small sample of a couple of players, But I was just like, this is awesome. Like, this is a great group. Maybe I just ended up with a great batch. But I thought, even relative to some of the high schoolers we've talked to at the combine over the last couple of years, I just thought this was a really good group. The three I just want to highlight: Trevor Condon, a high schooler from Georgia. He had more energy than I've ever seen from a high school player. Coleman Borthwick, a two-way player from Florida. That dude, and he's from like the Panhandle. So he is an incredibly interesting prospect and a very fun, confident personality. But far and away, the number one guy I talked to is Will Brick, a high school catcher from Tennessee. And this was one where he was one of my last interviews on Wednesday. But I had talked to multiple teams in the days before, and they're like, you got to talk to Will Brick. Like, this kid is unbelievable. It is like the level of it's. Yeah, people say this about people, and sometimes it's said not demeaning, but kind of like flippantly, like golden retriever energy. It's that, but like times 100, and so likable and so engaging. And also, he's a catcher, right? So like, his perspective on the game is so interesting. He's caught all of these best high school pitchers, and he reclassified up. He was supposed to be in the 2027 class. Now he's in 2026. I'm rooting for this kid big time. And I mean, I'll send the details of the conversation. I'll probably write about it at some point, but just his whole energy and personality was really, really, really infectious in a really cool way. And it just made me excited to just kind of see this next generation of kids. So just wanted to give the shine some love on the high school class of 2026. I think there's some fun kids that are about to hear their name called next week, or next month, I should say.
For my good, we return to our regularly scheduled programming of a mini segment, Jordan, that I'm going to call Root, Root, Root for the Rome Team. Baseball Pope strikes again. And there is an argument that this is the most important baseball Pope update that we have gotten all season long. For those of you new here, Pope Leo, 14th, Pope Bob, Southside legend, big Sox fan. We knew last week at game one of the 2005 World Series. But what we learned this week, courtesy of all people, AJ Pierzynski, who, as Ken Rosenthal notes in his story, The Athletic, the man once voted as the most hated player in baseball. Pierzynski went to Rome, went to the Vatican, and met with Pope Leo. "Hi, I'm AJ Pierzynski," the former major league catcher recalled telling Pope Leo, quote, "Oh, I know who you are. You don't have to introduce yourself." The first Pope in world history that didn't need AJ Pierzynski to introduce himself to them easily. Pierzynski gave the Pope the ball from game one of the 2005 World Series, the last out ball, a ball that Pierzynski had kept at home. He brought it to the Pope and gave it to him. This decision by Pierzynski, who I think is at times a polarizing character, as was the case during his playing career, as is the case now, at times in his media career, this is such a cool gesture, because this is not a jersey with the Pope's name, right? Pierzynski is literally sacrificing something that means something to him to give to the Pope in a way that I thought was very cool and like meaningful and indicative. And so like, kudos to AJ for doing that. I thought that was really rad. But then we just get some incredible other details in the story from Ken, like about how the Pope was actually also at game two of the 2005 World Series. And yet no one has found pictures of that yet. And he knows that. And then at the end, and this is what we've talked about so much, Pierzynski says, "Hey, White Sox are in first place." And the Pope, according to Pierzynski, quote, "Oh, I'm watching and paying attention. Don't worry." He just kind of smiled at me. So that, I think, concludes our takeaway. Does the Pope know about Munetaka Murakami? That answer is yes. So great job, AJ Pierzynski. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, obviously easily the most valuable contribution he's given to us since he joined the baseball media. And yeah, that last point is just amazing. And also, we've debated how much he's been keeping up with the White Sox. We always say, oh, well, he's a busy guy. Of course, he hasn't spent a lot of time in America. You got the time zone difference. But I also think, knowing these roots as a White Sox fan, it is entirely believable that an American dude from Chicago, when he does have some downtime to take a break from the weight of being the Pope, is probably checking from the Rome White of Sox. It all. Like,
yeah, dude, right.
Like, I think that's totally, that does, now does that mean he's, you know, got the at-bat app and is checking to see if Sir Anthony Dominguez can nail down the save? I don't know, but it absolutely tracks to me that on occasion he's checking in and seeing how the White Sox are doing. I think that is very believable.
How does he feel about Southside Stand Up? Like, Mr. Pope, if you're listening, come on the pod. I am officially inviting the Pope on the pod.
Finally. This whole time.
I just want to be very official. I mean, like, it was implied that we were interested. Two Jews would like to have the Pope on. We could make it like, you know, a religious, you know, melting pot thing. We'll talk Sox. We'll talk Old Testament. We'll talk even a little New Testament for him. Here's thoughts on what does the Pope think about the CBA negotiations? What does the Pope think about Mendoza? What does the Pope think about Randall Grichuk? These are the questions of our time, you know?
It's true.
But yes, this was so great. And there's like a picture. It's just so good. It makes me very happy.
All right, let's go to bad. Will Brick is a
Does this mean that
catcher.
Does this mean that Eric Kratz will meet the Dalai Lama? Okay, I'm done.
If he does, he is not, Dalai Lama is not going to say, I know who you are.
Could you imagine?
All right, let's move on to bad. I talked about Will Brick. That is a catcher from Memphis, Tennessee, who's having a really good time.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about one who's not having a very good time. Dalton Rushing. Former Baseball Barbecast guest, who we still believe is going to have a probably really good major league career.
Future probably Baseball future Barbecast barbecue. Guest, probably.
Yeah, he'll be back at some point. The Dodgers swept the Twins this week, but you wouldn't know it based on all the clips that you saw online, most notably involving some disagreements between Dalton Rushing and Shohei Ohtani. Involving seemingly some pitch calling on whether Ohtani should challenge a pitch that Dalton was like, hey, don't do that. And Shohei was right because, of course, he was. And then Dalton was just kind of going through it on the bench. Just he's been frustrating with his offense, clearly frustrating with his defense. Now, it is also notable. I mean, the reason why this has become a real story is because Will Smith is injured. And so Dalton Rushing normally not catching Shohei Ohtani. So they're clearly still trying to get on the same page. And this was a very blatant example of that not being the case. Afterwards, Dalton Rushing being very open, being like, yeah, like I'm not good. But really what's bad is some of the ways that Dalton was talking about this. Because him saying like, I'm embarrassed, I have to be better. That's all standard. But because he just looks like he's really struggling on the bench and like being so hard on himself visibly during the game in a way that you really aren't seeing that many major leaguers this consistently going through this, and that they keep showing that all these different guys in the Dodgers going and, you know, giving him support, which again is good teammates. And he's saying they're good teammates, but he also had a quote being like, this is embarrassing. I'm a grown man. I should be able to handle this. It's like, well, clearly you're struggling with this. So that's okay. But let's acknowledge this in a way that's not, you're not supposed to be struggling, but also it's just, I don't know, the way that this has spiraled, and obviously we don't love the way that people are talking about Dalton. Some of it is invited. Well, we get that. But
can I hop in?
I don't know. It's just, yeah, please.
Since we talked to Dalton, like literally the week after was when like he started doing some spicy stuff on the field, some of which I think was hilarious and some of which I think was actively bad and, you know, borderline villainous. And I think he would say that too. I think that part of the reason he became this lightning rod is because people want to hate watch the Dodgers and want to hate this operation for obvious reasons. And the front facing characters of the Dodgers for the last couple of years have been so like overtly likable between Ohtani and Freddie and Mookie and Yamamoto. Will Smith is the absence of anything. And so, like, Kike looks like he's having a great time, right? Like, they're, Miguel Rojas seems like a total sweetheart. And so you're not, like, who are you mad at? Blake Snell. Like, Blake Snell was the guy last year, right? He's barely played. And Dalton, being the Spice Lord, is the perfect target, right? He is the perfect recipient, perfect vehicle, perfect vessel for this Dodger frustration. Some of it is warranted, but it has gotten, like, the characterization of it is got much. I talked with him about it, like, when I saw him in Pittsburgh. It was clear that he was handling it okay. Like, some of it, again, is self-inflicted. I do think that, like, there's an important distinction here to be made between, like, him struggling and asking for support and accepting support is a good thing. Like, in life, right? If you are in need, you should receive and help, et cetera, et cetera. Dalton is also an immature individual. He is 24, 25. Like, he is learning how to live life. And that is not abnormal. Now, it is difficult because it's on a grand stage and there are other people his age or younger that are doing not dumb stuff, you know? And, like, I'm not trying to lower the bar for him. Like, there should be a standard here. But it is that it happened in public in the dugout where he looked so distraught that makes him kind of an easy target. And if I had to give advice to him, it's that, let's go into the tunnel for 5 minutes, right? Because you're just like,
oh my God.
You're making yourself easier to chip away at.
It sounds like such a small thing, but that is such a real, the amount of stuff that happens.
Guys do this all
away
the time,
from cameras,
dude.
In big league dugouts. It's all the time. And so, but because he's working from this position of people have already been analyzing his every move, that I think that's what's disappointing, that adjustment has not been made, regardless of the fact that another big part of this is that he just hasn't been hitting anywhere close to what he was in April, right? And so he's frustrated with his own performance. But also, and he says this in his interview, he knows that the most important thing is that the Dodgers are still winning a bunch of games. He's not costing them games. The Shohei thing is different because you can imagine that, like, that responsibility and that pressure is a different thing than him striking out three times. So
it's only
the second time
he's caught him this season.
Yeah.
My line for Dalton would be like, bro, if Shohei wants to throw 80 knuckleballs in a row,
God bless.
I would just do that. Like, whatever. Like, whatever, yeah. Right? Like, part of being a good catcher, and I would imagine what Shohei does respect about Will Smith is that there is a conversation there, that there is back and forth. But I would say, if you've come to a fork in the road, just do what Shohei wants. It's gotten a lot of people pretty far. I will take the reins now.
Go ahead. Your turn. Yep.
Sandy Alcantara broke the all-time Marlins strikeout record, which is super cool. The Marlins, though, appeared to forget. Not the Marlins players or the Marlins coaches, but the Marlins organization. He did this this week, and then there was no recognition of it up on the scoreboard. And so, like, hardcore Marlins fans who, like, knew the number and were counting, like, stood and clapped. The dugout stood and clapped. Sandy, like, took a second and, like, tipped his cap. It was unclear. He was like, oh, was I counting wrong? Did I miss something? And then after, like, 45 seconds, the Marlins put a graphic up, Sandy Alcantara, all-time strikeout leader, and then everyone clapped. It was just kind of uncomfortable, and I feel very bad for Sandy. Like, bungling that big of a moment is a real bummer.
Two things I would say about this. One is, some people are rolling their eyes of, like, who cares? It's the Marlins strikeout record. He beat Ricky Nolasco. Like,
Sandy,
how big of a deal is this,
cares.
Really? Sandy cares. No, I know. I'm just saying, I recognize that some people might feel that way. That said, the other part of the context is not only that, of course, Sandy cares and he's someone that, you know, fans should care about. It's that we weren't sure we were going to get here. You know, like, the fact that Sandy's even still on the Marlins for whatever reasons, you know, I imagine that before this season, when he wasn't traded and he's still been there, he was thinking, you know what, I can get this record. And a record that I'm sure is important to him because of what the Marlins mean to him and what he means to the Marlins. And I know that they've only won so much with him, but that's what's disappointing about it is that it was not always a given that he was going to get to 1,002 strikeouts with the Marlins. And I still expect him to get traded here in the next couple of years or next couple of months or who knows. You know, the fact that he did get there and then has this kind of disappointing, so, you know, acknowledgement. I do agree with you. That is, I think that qualifies as bad. I am right there with you. All right. More NL East chat. Oh my goodness. What a pod for the NL East. Jake, I know you do not care about whether the baseballs are different. That's totally fine.
Oh no.
However, I know you don't, but this is still Ugla.
Go for
if
a
this
walk.
Was just, if this was just Eno Saris tweeting out, hey, the balls are traveling way farther than they have been at the first 2 months of the season, I would not be bringing this up for Ugla because I know you hate talking about this. That's fine. But Eno and a few other people have noticed that since it turned to June, the baseballs are traveling a lot farther. There's a lot more home runs. So again, as I mentioned, normally I would not bring this up on the podcast. However, the fact that at the beginning of the month, there was a very funny clip of Ronald Acuna Jr. before he got injured, or maybe this was when he was already injured. I don't know. Anyway, there was a clip of Ronald Acuna Jr. sitting on the bench, inspecting two baseballs. In a way that you are thinking this is weird. Why is this baseball different than the other baseball? At the time, it looked like Acuna was just being a goofball on the bench. But now with this research, it's hard not to look at that and be like, did Ronald know something here? I just think it's so funny. And now if this continues, I will at least always attach Ronald, this clip of Ronald inspecting the baseballs, if it does reveal that, you know, if we end up with I think it was just on June 2nd was the clip of this. Great. But it's such a funny clip too, so I just wanted to make sure I bring it up if you have not seen it.
If you are listening and you're curious why I don't care about this, it's because I'm not smart enough to understand it. Ugla this week, Jordan. That's it. I'm just an idiot. My ugly this week is a lot simpler, and it is that Pedro Martinez is tweeting. He's like doing stuff for TBS, I believe. Yeah, former Barbacast guest. He and Dalton Rushing. He's doing stuff for like TNT, TBS, and they had Dodgers this week, and Justin Wroblewski pitched, and he tweeted this. I was impressed with Justin Wroblewski. He was like a shark out there. After tonight, he's now, quote, the shark. Okay?
So true, Pedro.
Go off, King. Like, yeah, okay, let's call him the shark. He then followed that up by saying, they have a lot of great whites in LA. And now Justin, the shark, Wroblewski is one of them. Hashtag MLB on TBS. This is great. Because I don't think they have a lot of great white sharks in LA, but the capitalization of G and W and great whites makes it seem as if he's saying like, is this like a Spencer Pratt endorsement?
A
lot of great whites in LA
direction.
it's just like the idea that Pedro Martinez was sitting there. It's like, this guy's like a shark. I'm Pedro Martinez. There's a 50% chance I actually can get this nickname to stick. Even though there's zero reason for it. It's not like Justin Wroblewski got bit by a shark or saw a shark or has a shark tooth or is like really sharky in any way. He's not even the sharkiest pitcher on the team. Like, there are other sharks. So him being the shark is just so nonsensical, and he will now be that forever. So on this show, moving forward, Justin the Shark Wroblewski is indeed Justin the Shark Wroblewski.
I guess just let's just dig into this a little bit more. What would it mean to be like a shark as a pitcher? Why is he in particular like a shark?
Like Shark Tank?
He's sharp. He's sharp. Sharp. Sharks are sharp. Their teeth are sharp.
He's got real bite.
Okay. His pitches have real bite. But like really Justin Wroblewski more than... I don't know.
But that's like why it's a perfect nickname.
I've never heard any... Have you ever heard any... Think about how many baseball games we've watched. The pitcher's dealing through six.
Like, pitchers...
And they, like, go to break. Imagine...
Oh, the number of bulldogs on the mound. You know how many bulldogs are on the mound? Tons of bulldogs. Sure. Never a shark. Horses. Pitchers could be horses. They could be bulldogs. They could be unicorns. Never sharks.
He comes off the mound. He roars, right? Like a lion. Like a lion. You know, but is they ever? Wobleski finishes a cat out there.
He's a shark out there. He's like a jungle cat hunting his prey, prowling. He's like a tiger prowling, a panther prowling on the mound.
Here's what I hope. If we see Pedro in the postseason, or maybe an all-star game, I don't know when we'll see Pedro again. We have to just be like, dude, tell me this.
Hit him with a why. Bro?
All right. I'm why shark, bro? Finding...
Maybe Pedro like went to the aquarium that day and just had sharks on the brain. Was it Shark Week? Could it have been Shark Week?
Shark Week's later, right? Oh, you think it's like an ad?
Or no, he was just locked into Shark Week.
I think it's in July is when they do Shark Week. But I was gonna say it's Shark Week being like, hey Pedro, call a pitcher a shark and then do like hashtag Shark Week. It's like I got you. It's Justin Wroblewski.
Oh, easy. Yeah, it's Wroblewski. All right, that's our pod. No more shark chat. I'm glad we were able to get zoology today. Yeah, go ahead. What you got?
You're watching on YouTube. What a freaking week for the Buffalo Sabres. Yarmo has been absolutely cooking this offseason, including trading for the number 4 overall pick in tonight's NHL draft. I am really torn on who I think they should take. It is in Buffalo, which fires me up. Should they go with Caleb Malhotra or Viggo Bjork or Keaton Verhoef or Daxon Rudolph? Who's to say? Chase Reed? I've been studying film. I spent all my MLB draft combine studying NHL draft prospects because Yarmo traded for the number 4 pick. Alex Tuck, we salute you. Bo Byram, we salute you. But we march forward as Sabres fans with the,
Sabres
all
on
of
the
our
warp,
beloved man. with Zach Benson and friends. So go Sabres, go. I'm looking forward to seeing who they take tonight. All right, we're done. Thank you to Andrew Hart.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you to Colin Brennan for producing. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back on Monday talking more fall.
Y'all are all power sharks.